Greetings, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Casterbrus podcast. Yes, with a K. Available on Casterbrus.com, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and Audioboo. It all started as a mild curiosity by these Casterbrites, and now it's turned into quite a spirit of adventure, don't you think? Listen.
Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Christian Corley. I'm the editor of Casterbrus.com. With me on this week's Casterbrus podcast with a K is James McLean. Hi, James.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm quite festive.
Are you really? Oh, that's good, because we're here to talk about festive Doctor Who, aren't we? We're recording this podcast on Sunday. Hopefully, I'm planning to get it out on Sunday evening, the podcast, that is, before James says anything. And because it's my birthday tomorrow as well, so I definitely plan to get it out on Sunday evening, the podcast, that is. And I'm glad you're feeling festive. How did you enjoy Christmas itself?
I enjoyed it festively.
Festively was the best way, yeah. I think. Unfortunately, Brian's not with us. He does seem to have been enjoying Christmas a little bit too much and lost his voice. One imagines there's been lots of running around and shouting at Ragnos or something in the Terra Nova household. Now, it's the 28th of December today. 2014. And it's a Sunday. And it is 40 years to the day, but not the day of the week, if it was 39 years ago, it would have been the day of the week. It was 40 years ago to the day that Tom Baker leapt onto our screens in Robot as the Fourth Doctor.
Okay.
Which is, I'm not one for sort of in-universe anniversary type things, because they kind of they start off as being quite interesting, and then, as you may have seen on Facebook and Twitter and so forth, people start celebrating, you know, the moment when Sarah Jane first revealed her sonic lipstick or some bollocks like that. People just go TT with it. But this is quite a significant moment for Doctor Who, because it was the beginning of 7 years of Doctor Who that remains, in quality terms, I wouldn't say the quality of the 7 years is unsurpassed, but the quality of the performance by the lead actor, no one's come close to matching it yet. Okay, maybe David Tennant's come close to matching it, but he still didn't do 7 years, so it is a landmark in Doctor Who terms.
If you say so.
I do say so.
Okay, if you wish.
I do wish.
if you'd be doing this
How do you feel about
leading the show? I find it utterly pointless, mate. You could do this any date's got some relevance to it.
Well, yeah, I know it is. Oh. And I've already made that point.
I know. Well, then, why are we talking about
this? Because it's Tom Baker.
Oh, for God's sake. I love the guy, but, you know, haven't we talked about him enough? We talked about him for 7 years, didn't we? Well, we didn't, but we would have.
Well, when we were doing the podcast with the Red Can't Spell Yet.
Oh yes, more than that, wasn't it? Oh no, no 70. Yeah, oh no, no. We Fair enough. Yeah,
the podcast from an embryo. That one.
Absolutely. Yeah, for a while. Yeah. I know. I mean, I know what you mean. It's something that fans like to celebrate, but in the end, I don't know. You know, Doctor Who fandom, doesn't it get you down a bit after a while?
Well, I don't really consider myself as interested in it. I know it's utterly bizarre, but you know what I mean.
It just seems any excuse to celebrate something or to knock something down. I don't know.
Yeah.
I got for Christmas something that you mentioned the other week. I got the vault.
Herpes? Oh, the vault, right, okay.
Sorry, I beat you to the sexual insult. Yeah, and it's just interesting in there where they're talking about fandom and, you know, in the 80s and the adulation fandom had over Adric disappearing and the powerless fans looking for something to feel powerful over almost, and I don't know.
Do you think that's what it was about Adric?
I don't know. I think fans disliked him at the time, and they obviously do now, which I still sort of find bewildering. You know, the amount of dislike for him.
Oh, the amount. There's obviously episodes where he's absolutely terrible, but there's other episodes where he's not. So.
Well, that's it, and yeah, it's
you
such
can
a...
you can say that about many companions, really.
Exactly. So I don't know. I understand what you mean. It's something. It was an interesting era. I still think it's slightly overrated as a whole era.
Well, that's why I didn't really go into the year and think more towards the quality of his performances. Because, you know, some of those scripts were whippet shit. And he managed to raise them beyond perhaps what they deserve to be.
Okay, devil's advocate. Did he sometimes damage them? Because there were times where you could see he was bored. And
yeah.
It felt almost frivolous. You could almost feel like he was choosing when to be frivolous and when to be serious, just almost on a whim.
Give me an example and I'll tell you what I think.
Oh, give me a week to think through 7 years of his era.
I don't think there's much in the early days. I refute that last statement, actually. I withdraw it. Because I think you can tell he's a little bit frustrated with some of his dialogue in the first season or so. For reasons that he himself has said, that he's saying John Pertwee's lines, isn't he? And I think take Ark in Space, where he does seem to be uncharacteristically grumpy.
I was thinking the same for Revenge of the Cybermen, actually.
Right, yeah.
That part one, he seems quite distant and irritable, and his whole performance seems very detached.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, obviously, later on, there are times where you feel that. And I don't blame him, to be fair, a lot of the time, especially through William's era, where he just looks totally, you know, he plays it for a joke because he obviously feels it is just ending up as a joke. And sometimes I wonder whether a bit more gravitas from him would have anchored.
But well, I mean, if you take something like The Pirate Planet, though, which is a lot of it is mirthful, and then you get that moment in the pirate captain's trophy room, where it's all gone, and I think that I think in that example it works perfectly because there is laughs in there, a lot of laughs. You know, are you sure this planet is where it's supposed to be? All that stuff, and then he just that bombshell reaction from the Doctor is a perfect contrast to the rest of it, and it all of a sudden the viewer realizes just the gravity of the situation.
But then there are other scenes, like when he's on when he's walking the plank, or when he's dealing with the guards in the city, where you feel if he wasn't sending it up, the scene might carry more strength than inevitably it did. So I know when it could be dramatic, you could see he enjoyed it. When it wasn't dramatic, you didn't feel like he was trying because to him there seemed no point. It was a stupid scene. That sort of thing. I sometimes wonder. Could he, being such a powerful actor, if he'd been in the right frame of mind, made those weaker scenes more powerful by not giving in to them almost, not giving in to the silliness?
Yeah. I mean, we'll never know, but it is an interesting supposition, yeah. Let's, just while we're on the topic of Christmas, I got the Doctor Who Annual 2015, which I'm very pleased to have. I don't know why I got it. Because, I mean, obviously there's a key reason why I got it. But the last couple of years, I haven't had a Doctor Who annual, so I just imagined I wasn't going to get it. But what I have also got, which I'm very pleased with, and I know it's an early recommendation, but I suspect we'll be talking about something else in recommendations, is Tommy Cooper, Just Like That, by John Fisher. Which is like a scrapbook of Tommy Cooper. The scripts, there's letters, gags, there's posters. If you're in any way interested in British comedy, then this is an absolutely superb book. And I believe, you know, I'm not a materialistic person, I believe my wife got this for quite a low price from one of those popular shops that have the word pound in the title. And it's about, it must be a couple of hundred pages long, at least 100 pages long. It's chock-a-block. You'll need a magnifying glass to read some of it. Because there's newspaper cuttings in there, so... with small text. It's really, really good. I've only got to like page 10 and it took me an hour to get there trying to make out all the small print in the newspapers and stuff, and it's a really good book. So if you're a fan of Tommy Cooper, sorry, just clear my throat there. There you go. That's one for the American listeners. Yes. So last Christmas, we had the time of the Doctor, didn't we?
Yeah.
Yeah. You see what I did there?
Yeah. And, just like that.
Yeah, just like that. And this Christmas, we had last Christmas.
Not like that.
Yeah. Ah, no, not like that.
No. Just so like it's that, yeah.
Yeah. So the main reason for this week's podcast is to talk about Doctor Who, but the secondary reason in this case is to speak about Last Christmas, the Doctor Who Christmas special for 2014, which starred Peter Capaldi in his first proper Christmas special, and with various things going on, and you know, a lot of people have compared it to things such as Inception. And a few other, there's the alien reference and everything as well. I wonder whether I really enjoyed this Doctor Who Christmas special. I don't think I've enjoyed the Doctor Who Christmas special this much since A Christmas Carol. And I certainly haven't. No, I haven't enjoyed a Doctor Who Christmas special since Christmas Carol, really. And I haven't enjoyed a Doctor Who Christmas special this much since The Christmas Invasion. I think it's probably fair to say. We ran a poll after the episode, which is probably worth just having a look at.
You do that.
We will do that. Yes, because we basically
just like
asked,
that.
Just like that. Yeah, indeed. Poll. Glass poll. No, that doesn't work, does it? And basically, we ran a poll after the episode aired, asking the readers on Casterbus how they felt. Well, which of the Christmas specials was their favourite, basically, after the episode aired. So, you know, there can be some skewing in there, let's say. Now,
yes, but before you do.
Yeah.
You do the same each year, so there is a comparative the approach.
Indeed.
So carry on.
Yes, thank you. So, in how did Last Christmas measure up for you, square brackets poll, that's the name of the article, we offered you the choice to vote for The Christmas Invasion, The Runaway Bride, Voyage of the Damned, The Next Doctor, The End of Time Part 1, A Christmas Carol, The Doctor, The Widow and the Wardrobe, The Snowman, The Time of the Doctor and Last Christmas. You had one vote only, and simple question, after watching Last Christmas, my favourite Doctor Who Christmas special is. If I view the results, Last Christmas gets an immense 30%, 30.1%. A Christmas Carol, 17.78%. Christmas Invasion, 14.55%. And then under 10% each are The Snowman, Time of the Doctor, Voyage of the Damned, End of Time Part 1, Runaway Bride, Next Doctor, Doctor the Widow and the Wardrobe, Creeping Home at 2.02%.
Ouch.
Yes, indeed. So there is a lot. There seems to be a lot of goodwill towards this episode, and I think a lot of this has probably got something to do with the support cast. We had a look also at the co-stars, and this wasn't a poll because that would have been quite unfair. But it struck me as I did this, because I was taken, as many people were, by Faye Marseille, who played Shona McCulloch. Who hails from not far from this very podcast studio.
Right.
And so I thought, well, I can't write an entire article about her, so let's, you know, we'll bring in the other people. So there's Natalie Gamidi, who'd been in Coronation Street previously and 2013 Strictly Come Dancing as a contestant. There's Nick Frost, who I have to say, Nick Frost is, you know, just seems to me to be a competent actor. There's a lot of people who think he's kind of the greatest comedy actor in the world. I'm not one of those people.
Okay.
He's quite competent actor. I've nothing against him at all. I just don't think
absolutely
special.
Not. And I'm sure if money had afforded Ricky Gervais, they would have had Ricky Gervais judging by his performance.
Okay. Maureen Beattie, who eagle-eyed, long-memory viewers may have recognised from Casualty many years ago. Michael Troughton, son of Patrick Troughton. And Samuel Anderson made a nice surprise visit to the show.
Didn't he look thin?
He did look thin. No, he did look a little thinner to me. I thought, well, actually, initially, I thought he'd put on height. So
as suggested.
Well, yeah.
The script suggested that.
Yes, it did, didn't it?
Jokingly.
Yeah. So, Yeah, that didn't help me at all. I had to watch it again. So yeah, he did. So maybe he's been working out. So I am very enthusiastic about this episode. It seems to me from the reaction that a lot of viewers have been. James, how are you feeling about Last Christmas, the TV episode, not last?
I was just looking at last year, and I haven't actually found the comparative poll for the Christmas specials.
Right.
But just looking at how it fared at Time of the Doctor, Matt's Finest Hour was 23.58% out of a 1,107 votes. So
right.
If you can find the comparative poll with Time of the Doctor to the rest, it'd be interesting to see what it scored.
Yes.
How did I find it? Well, those who listened to our podcast last week will know how.
I listened.
You did? Did you?
I did. Yeah, I enjoyed it. It was good.
Yeah. Okay. We'll know how we were both very reticent. No, not reticent. The wrong word. Very apprehensive.
Yes.
And for the first 10 minutes, I loathed it.
Okay.
And then once I realised that, Santa was not going to be doing a Robin Hood and suddenly becoming historically as Robin Hood, even though Robin Hood in the Doctor Who continuity is utterly against everything that's historically known about the character, we let it go. I was kind of worried we'd be having to let go of the idea that Santa is canonical to their world.
Yeah.
And as soon as it became clear he wasn't, and it was done in a very clever way, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was very good. I didn't think it was the supporting cast that did it for me. I thought Capaldi was very good. I thought Clara was very good.
Mm-hmm.
And there was lots of good little moments. To be fair, the supporting cast had very little script at all.
Well, that's why that's not uncommon. And I think the reason why I was so taken with them is that they seemed to do with an awful lot with what they were given.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in standard length episodes, supporting cast, if you go beyond more than three main supporting cast, it becomes a shambles because you don't know who these people are. They don't really seem to have much relevance. Contrast it with, take something like Hyde, where you have two supporting cast.
Mm.
Excellent episode. Take something with a busier cast, such as, these are very, these are random choices.
What's about Into the Dalek?
All right, Into the Dalek's a brilliant one because, and you've got
people.
Yeah, it's full of people, and there's only really perhaps two of those people that are worth that you get any investment in. So,
mm-hmm.
So yeah, good example. Yeah, thank you for that.
Okay.
So I thought they did an awful lot with what they had.
Yeah, I thought it was beautifully done. As I've said in previous podcasts, I've really grown to like Time of the Doctor more than I did at the time.
Yeah,
of the Doctor. Of the Time of the Doctor. So I've really grown. So that is actually one of my favourite Christmas episodes. But this was a far smoother run.
Hmm.
Time of the Doctor has got a fantastic script, I've got to say, having rewatched it. While the exposition and the convoluted attempts to try and tie things up are a bit naff, some of the supporting characters don't work for me. Well, as you say, what of the supporting characters there are.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a brilliant script. It's funny. Smith plays it so well. So does Coleman. But this was just very well done. The story was good. There was drama. There was character. That's something we should probably talk about. Is I do feel it felt like it was a double script. That it was there was two different versions.
Yes.
One where Coleman stayed. One where Coleman went.
Yeah.
It felt very much like that to me. As if it was. There was two different outcomes for this, depending, which isn't a bad thing. We've seen it and we've seen this sort of thing happen. If this is the case, as Delta and the Bannermen, where there was a chance there was going to be a changeover,
yeah,
and there wasn't, and the poor girl had to go off on her bike by herself at the end of the episode, tail between her legs. But yeah, so I think it was a very clever episode, very very clever. So I was totally wrong to be worried about it last week.
I think, given some of the Christmas episodes we've had and the trailers that we have, the thing about trailers is you get a idea presented to you completely mm-hmm. beyond context. And the scenario offered in the teaser from Children in Need Night appeared to be some form of conclusion, didn't it? Because it was a conclusion of a situation. And, you know, you've seen mm-hmm. you've seen the episode now, dear listener, so you know. I hope you have, because you're listening to the wrong podcast if you haven't. So you know the moment with the slinkies and the tangerines coming in, the explosion, etc. And Santa wandering in all sort of badass, as only Santa can do. I think you'll agree. And it's and you know that was presented as a sort of concluding scenario to a situation. Now, what we didn't know, and which we should have done, because we should have guessed it, because it's what they do virtually every year, is that it's from like the beginning of the episode, more or less. So, anyone who's worried about the episode based on that, probably had the rug pulled from under them completely.
Well, I was still worried, even though it was the beginning of the episode in the show.
Yeah.
When he reappeared on the base to save everyone, I was just thinking, oh, for God's sake. This is my nightmare come true.
Yeah.
So I could still understand you being worried throughout, because it did feel like that they were going to play this. And I don't know. It was... I still... You know, part of me would have rather had it without those bits, but it probably wouldn't have worked. I didn't like the elves at all.
The elves were terrible, I thought. They let it down for me.
As I said to Brian last week, this is, you know, an example of sort of a comedy that is less sort of, it's less diegetic. It's more to do with the audience. Mm-hmm. They're speaking to the audience more than it's almost like Stewie in Family Guy, yeah. where everyone is aware the baby is talking, but it's the audience who is finding the baby funny by talking. The people don't in the show, they're aware of it, but it's not humorous to them. Yeah. And it sort of felt a bit like that. These sort of characters are common now in contemporary comedy, thanks to Joss Whedon, largely, I imagine. And they get frustrating because they're not talking with the audience. So they're not talking with the characters, they're really talking with the audience. It's like Panto.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Their comedy is addressing the audience, unlike, say, Robert Holmes' is Jago from Talents of Wing Chiang, where the comedy is within the world. You know, the doctor finds him amusing because he knows he's playing, because he knows what sort of character he is. And it sort of gets, it feels not lazy, but it feels a bit sort of, I don't know, cheap. Mm. So, yeah, I wasn't over keen on the elves. And I, as I say, Nick Frost, he was fine. It was very much a Ricky Gervais performance. It was a bit obvious. But the beauty of the episode was pretty much the last 20 minutes, probably.
Yeah.
I also quite like the fact it did self-reference where clearly these creatures were based on the facehuggers. Yeah. That it
twice. Sort of,
it hands in the air on that, wasn't it?
Yeah. But yeah. Twice as well. When Michael Troughton's character mentioned it, and then later on at the end, on the list.
Mm. Yes, yes. So what did you think of Shona? Because obviously that's something...
Yeah, I thought she's marvellous. I thought she's really good. I thought, you know, like most people, I was amused and possibly bemused by the dancing, but it all held together really well. It was a very good dance, I thought, as well, actually. But
yes, it was.
It was, yeah, it was. And what, throughout that as well, she seemed to be a character who was a little more interested in the situation and what was going on and trying to work things out in her own way than the rest of them were.
Well, this is the whole argument to get the Delta and the Bannermen.
Yeah,
that she was being cut off companion cloth.
Indeed.
And it did felt like at the end, or even down to her situation at the very end, in her boring, mundane apartment flat,
yeah,
as if it was being groomed as companion material, yeah. Like Donna.
And wanting to swap numbers as well.
Yes. So it did feel almost as if that was going down that route. And as we've said in our writers group, we do. I have a feeling she'll probably pop up again. I think she might reoccur.
I do hope so.
I mean, she didn't blow me away. I mean, people say she was so fresh and different, but she still felt like companion material.
Yeah,
she had to prove that she was different, that she has to do things quirkily. And that sort of kind of disappoints me. That if there is this sort of like checklist these days of that companions have got to be slightly different to everyone else, and I think, do they have to be? Can't they become different by experience?
Yeah, yeah.
like Ian and Barbara, you know, very ordinary teachers, made different experience. They proved themselves through trial. But I was very happy to see Clara stay, because what we saw today, that episode, was very much the dynamic I was looking for in Series 8, which was missing. It's slightly abrasive, but there was a connection there.
Yeah.
And the ending was very, very sweet as well. So, yeah, I thought it was a really nice outro for Christmas too.
What about the contrast between the Doctor in Last Christmas and the Doctor in his last televised adventure?
You mean the finale?
Yes.
The finale to this Christmas episode.
Yeah.
Well, he felt more like the Listen Doctor to me.
Yeah, he was a proactive Doctor, wasn't he? Even though he was trapped in several layers of nightmare.
Mm.
You know, he was working things out and he was realizing what was going on, as opposed to the, I can only imagine he'd been to Glasgow before the episode and got pissed in Dark Water and Death in Heaven and had no idea what was going on and kind of stumbled through.
He did, yes. He felt utterly neutered and ineffective. Yeah. And I think, as we said last podcast, between Listen and the finale, but those felt like two different Doctors.
Yeah.
He didn't feel like the Doctor from Listen would have reacted as the Doctor in the finale would have reacted to Missy. He wouldn't have been off put. And I still think a lot of this is to do is that they brought in Danny Pink and disrupted the ability for the writers as well and the actors to find themselves, because there wasn't time. So I think the companion helps inform the Doctor in a lot of ways, in the sense that if you look at Ace and the Seventh Doctor, or Sarah Jane and the Fourth, or Romana and the Fourth, the dynamic informs the personality to a certain degree.
Yeah.
And if you disrupt that and divert the companion away from the Doctor, I think it becomes harder for the Doctor to find his grounding, both in the writing and in the acting. So I think he's had a hard time through Series 8 for that reason. So I'm kind of hoping they're settling with a more listen Doctor and not this sort of weak grandfather, which was almost being played out. It was almost like watching Peter Cushing. You know, that Doctor, it felt like that. You could put the Peter Cushing Doctor in that finale and he wouldn't have felt particularly out of place.
No. Yeah, couldn't argue with that. Now, there's been a lot of talk, and we mentioned a little bit before, about the various things that seem to have informed the creation of this episode. We've got Alien, that's the original Ridley Scott movie, which starred the War Doctor.
Yes.
We've got Miracle on 34th Street, and any number of Father Christmas related things. I think I mentioned one earlier. And Inception, of course. But I think also there's an aspect of the Hogfather in there as well. With the whole, you know, it being that time of year and there being a need for a particular character to assist. And, you know, the Hogfather's all about belief and a finite amount of belief, and a particular character being created to fulfill a need for that belief. So I think that's in there as well. I do love the Hogfather, I have to say.
So, yeah, I liked the book, didn't like the show, didn't like the film particularly.
I think it was a good attempt. It's better than the first one. They made three films, didn't they? They did Colour of Magic, Hogfather, and Going Postal. I think each one's progressively better.
Well, Adams and Pratchett are very hard to realise. The benefit with Adams is that you have the prose is within the narrator, so you don't lose the narrator's voice in Hitchhikers.
Sure.
While with Pratchett, you lose the narrator's voice because he's no longer there at all, which is a bit of a shame, which I think is why Pratchett doesn't translate as well. Mm. I also, you've got to say, and I rolled my eyes a little, there's obviously an essence of Moffat in there. You know, don't look, don't think, don't blink, your eye.
Yeah.
And at the beginning, I say, oh God, here we go again. So,
I wasn't so much here we go again, but there was that kind of, another one of these sort of thing. But that kind of got, interestingly, was kind of retconned, wasn't it, within the script? Was it within the script or not? I'm not sure whether it was in the script or not. No, I can't recall. But it's like their abilities changed throughout the nightmare, didn't it?
Did they?
Yeah, well, I'm not disagreeing. Later on, they were able to pull people through monitors.
Oh, yes, true.
So, yeah, there's this kind of development of what they can and cannot do, which is good because, you know, there is no consistency in Nightmares, is there?
Yeah.
It's like, hey, and we're back to Tommy Cooper, actually, because there's a joke that Tommy Cooper used to do, which is wholly relevant. Do bear with me. Where he basically, I'm flipping through this as if I can find the actual gag that I'm looking for, and I probably won't find it. But it's along the lines of, he goes to the doctor and says, I'm having this recurring dream. Here he goes. I said, Doctor, I keep dreaming. He said, what's that? And I said, I keep dreaming these beautiful girls. These beautiful girls keep coming towards me. Keep coming towards me. I keep pushing them away. These beautiful girls keep coming towards me, and I keep pushing them away. Pushing them away. He said, what do you want me to do? I said, break my arm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there we go. podcast with it just like that. So yeah, I'm really, really, really happy with this episode, I have to say. And I'm going to get into it a bit more with more depth later on when I write my review for Casterbus. But on the whole, I mean, if I was to throw a rating at it, I'd be saying 8.5 out of 10, I think.
Yeah, I don't normally like those sort of reoccurring dream episodes because they always end with that. Is this still a dream?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, everything in Doctor Who has been a dream since the last episode of Trial of a Time Lord. He's still in the Matrix.
But and the only thing that I did wonder, and I didn't know whether this was part of the nightmare, the blood on the forehead, was that just a dream symptom? Because in the last, when they awake, there was no marks on their forehead again.
Mm.
I didn't know whether that was just a sort of not to infer it's still a dream, but to sort of suggest that what he'd been saying was part of the dream fantasy of what these creatures did to you. You know,
Well, that's what happens with these situations as well, isn't it? Then there's an establishment, and then there has to be a method of successfully divorcing the two. And it can be easy not to fully divorce them. I think the change in scenario is what really succeeds in doing it, I think, isn't it?
I think it's, again, I think what will make this episode very interesting, especially if data ever emerges, is quite how the process went about writing it. Because, like I said, I am still pretty sure that from various stuff that we've heard, I'm pretty sure that Coleman was looking at leaving.
Yeah, we should probably talk a bit more about that, shouldn't we? Because we were told that there was a very strong chance that she wouldn't be renewing her contract for Series 9. Now, she said it's going to be... She has said a whole series.
She has, yeah.
In her statement. Whether that means she's in every episode or if she's going to maybe leave halfway through and then pop back for the finale or whatever, we don't know. Some people are saying that there's going to be a new companion halfway through, which might be a return for Shona McCulloch. Faye Mansell's
could be.
Character. Could be. May not be.
I don't think it is. I think Coleman's staying for the whole show.
Yeah.
I think the decision was made, whether it was her, BBC, production.
Well, ultimately, it'll have been her, won't it? Changing her mind.
Well, it depends on what... I mean, we've heard various rumours, which I'm not going to go into, but it does depend on which story. Some stories would lend to possibly being a change of mind on the production or the BBC side.
Yeah.
Depending on what you hear.
Maybe she's heard who the new producer is going to be and has decided that that's someone she wants to work with.
Oh, absolutely. It could be something as simple as that. Like I say, I'm a bit tentative about going into things like that, but the bottom line is that it does feel like my gut feeling is till a late stage she was off.
Yeah.
And then very late on she came back on, but there had been a provision made in case there was that changeover. That's how it felt to me. This script felt like it was introducing a new companion. It felt like we'd already had little hints that now Moffat's turned around and said, forget about, you know, the pregnancy, the listen with the grandchild mm-hmm. is suddenly now not important. Now, to me, that all felt like it was leading up to the fact that she was being written out.
Yeah.
Because suddenly, again, in typical Moffat land, it seems to happen a lot, there seems to be a retcon. And that seems to be all thrown out the window. So it seems at the moment. And we're moving on. So it does make me wonder whether there was two versions. I wondered whether she was pregnant or whether that would be whether the old Jenna would have carried on, would have still had that scene, and there'd have been a reference to a child being born, so that storyline would have carried fluid. the Olsen Pink, wasn't it? Olsen, was it? Olsen.
Olsen. It was Descendant. Yeah.
So that would have carried on, and then either she'd have passed away then, or he wouldn't be able to go back, and whether that would open, I don't know. But I just kind of felt that this could have been an end story for her and an opening for a new companion who was showcased throughout it compared to the other characters, even down to the Slay. She was still being pushed.
She was the last one off, wasn't she?
She was the last one off, and she had this very odd scene in her house as well, which sort of set her up, but it resolved her in a very odd way. The dream had meant that she'd sorted out her relationship issues. That was sort of the inference.
If that's what Dave was, yeah.
Assuming, yes, that was what Dave was.
She might have been a couch potato and been talking about the TV station.
And she'd crossed it off her list. How wise. So I don't know.
There's only so much Would I Lie to You anyone can watch, really, isn't there?
Top Gear. especially over Christmas. But yeah, so I don't know. It felt like, but I'm really pleased about it. As I said, I've really gone off Clara this last series. Really gone off her. To the point I was very happy with her to go. But that last moment with the two of them, I felt I'm kind of glad she might have a series where she can work with Capaldi properly without having to be working with two male characters. And I like their relationship. I like this idea of this sort of paternal uncle bond that they sort of have in this sort of relationship. Maybe there is a suggestion, God forbid, on television that she might still have feelings for him in a weird way, but it doesn't matter. There's a sort of nice non-Rose-like relationship there. And I don't know. I think Doctor Who's always, you know, before this, Doctor Who was always about family, wasn't it? That dysfunctional families in the TARDIS for Davison, or sort of uncle, niece sort of thing that I felt you got with Joe Grant. Or extended family you'd have with Ian, Barbara, grandfather. You know, there's a lot about family in there, or that feeling of altruistic, you know, non-sexual chemistry.
Sure.
And we've lost that in the new series a lot. It's all been about sort of, you know, will they, won't they? It's been folding in there, here, there and everywhere.
Yeah.
Be it Rose, Martha, Amy, even Clara. So if they sort of have something which is a little more like how close friends can be without this need to getting married, I think that's, I still always think that's quite a nice message for a show to be pushing. You know, that friendship is important, especially for kids. Or not. I don't know.
No, well, I wouldn't argue with that, I don't think. I don't think I have any reason to argue with that. Doesn't seem sensible to argue with that.
No, absolutely not. But she was good, I thought. She was good all the way through. Did her makeup work in the last scene? I don't know if it did particularly, but it didn't matter.
I never noticed any problem with it. I think possibly the eyes were too bright. Well, that's the only thing.
Yeah, really, it didn't really faze me. I thought it was a beautiful scene. I think it was nice, this idea of the Doctor getting a second chance. I thought they played the revelations of the lie out well.
Yeah.
I like that little scene where he asks her to go and get tea, very sort of Patrick Troughton, her reply and his reply nicely dovetailed. I thought Danny worked well in it. So yeah, it was a brilliant episode. I think that's all I can say. Very, very good.
It's certainly one I'll be rewatching. I do find myself not rewatching Doctor Who all that much these days. Doctor Who a lot.
I liked also liking and listen. Capaldi did his little evil Tom Baker smile.
Yes, he did. Yes.
while with Tom Baker it looked ingratiating, with Capaldi it always looks evil, but it's still amusing.
Yeah.
But yes, I'm hoping they're going to carry the listen trend, because that seems to be where he works best.
Yeah.
I also liked, I hate to say this because it's, you know, talk about real people. There's this sort of TV, I'll use this term, TV trope of autism that's used in TV. I'm not saying this is to do with autistic people as in real life. This thing that he can't be touched. And it's in this episode, it's almost like the only person he can be touched by now is, he'll accept, is Clara. I like that, you know. No, Clara can. I will hold hands with Clara, but that's it. I won't hold hands with anyone else. Well,
yeah.
In deep breath, that would have been a problem. And as I say, this is TV or sort of TV sort of Asperger's autism sort of Sheldon Cooper monk sort of thing, rather than real true diagnosis, but is that I kind of found that quite amusing with the characters, sort of a kind of a interesting quirk that this Doctor has compared to his last one. And I like the way that was played out. So, yeah, no, there's a lot of good stuff in there.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, we're going to move on. So, thumbs up for Last Christmas.
Yeah.
The Doctor Who episode, not the Wham song. I think we're all clear on that, aren't we?
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. Good. Okay, we're going to move on in a minute. Until then, enjoy this week's podcast. Leave us a review on iTunes. I really need to edit the beginning of that so there isn't such a long lead-in, don't I? Okay, we have a couple of other things to talk about. I think we'll begin in the sensible way. We'll just do one of these just to demarcate things. And then you, dear listener, can listen to this.
Coming soon from Big Finish Productions, Doctor Who, the highest science.
We're close to the centre of the 14 activity. When the flicker starts up again, the exact source should register here.
Good. And all the bleeping can stop and we can do something interesting. When do I get to meet some monsters?
Never, hopefully.
I think you may have spoken too soon. A couple of giant tortoises over there. Still, they're friendly.
Chalunian!
Not friendly.
When you've been a soldier as long as I have, you can smell parasites from the other side of the black hole. Forward! We shall crush the spineless fleshies in our mighty claws.
Oh, you're shallow, Vicar. My mother used to say you had scaly green skin and terrible halitosis.
Really? It seems the reports of my breath have been greatly exaggerated.
Second pilot, report the success of your attack immediately.
Cell, what's happening?
The psychic shock of contact with me incapacitated the subject's physical body. The mind has now shielded itself.
Then break through the shield.
I will try, but it is strong.
I must know. The highest science. Ask it about the highest science.
Wouldn't it be best to leave well alone? Mighty civilization brought down by terrible discovery. I know there are loads of versions of the Sakrat myth, but that's a common factor in all of them. So maybe just forgetting about the higher science would be a good idea?
I'm afraid I can't just ignore a Fortean flicker.
I suppose not. Although sometimes, Doctor, I wish you wouldn't treat the universe like it was your own personal responsibility.
Big Finish. We love stories.
So that's the highest science, which was originally released about 20, 21 years ago. Gosh. 20 years ago or so. Written by Gareth Roberts, who, as you know, is now a TV writer, dear listener. It's been adapted by Jack Rayner of Doctor Who magazine fame and her own rather good novels over the years as well. And produced by Cavan Scott, who's written a few of his own, and directed by Scott Hancock, who's also written a few Big Finish audios. Now, it's an interesting thing because there's two of these. There's this one and there's the Russell T Davies... Damaged Goods as well, which has also been adapted from the old Virgin New Adventures, which back, you know, 20 years ago, this is what new Doctor Who was like. This was, you know, there was no, we didn't sit waiting on a Saturday evening for Doctor Who to start, did we? We popped down to W.H. Smith's to find out what the latest story was.
Yep.
Basically. So to see this translated into TV, into audio format, and you know, it's not the only thing that's been translated. You know, obviously, Human Nature, Paul Cornell's 2007 Doctor Who story was translated into TV, and there are various things that change in that one, and it seems that there's things that change here. There possibly, I'm a little anxious isn't the word, perhaps the word that you used earlier, which you nearly said reticent, and then you said apprehensive,
yeah,
is Benny doesn't seem in from that trailer, she seems just a little bit too Benny as it was. what do you know what I mean? Are we in tune on this?
To Liz Hurley?
No, I'm thinking just to the, you know, too much what the character was. Is I'm feeling that she isn't a character that would perhaps really work now.
Okay, yeah.
You know, as conceived, she was, you know, a bit of a... She was, you know, she was a female... I was going to say Han Solo, but I should mean a female Indiana Jones, wasn't she, essentially? She was kind of wise-cracking, smart-ass archaeologist.
Well, she is a lot of what sort of informed people like Rose, yeah, and I suppose to a certain degree, Donna. Yeah, because she was, you know, if you think back to the old series, you really only got Ace, who really had any room to stand by herself.
Yeah.
Even Sarah Jane's relationships, her stories sort of followed the same sort of trends as Joe Grant. Get split up, meet the good rebels, encourage them to do something. You know, there wasn't much else. So yeah, Benny's did sort of inform a lot of how the new series went.
Yeah.
And probably in a clunky way compared to how that has become a far more universal model in television, let alone in Doctor Who.
Mm.
So yeah, no, I think you're probably right. I think there probably is, and that it probably is a difficulty for it. I must admit, while I enjoyed Love and War, and while I enjoyed the other ones that she's appeared in The Big Finish.
Oh, they did Love and War as well, didn't they? Yeah, I forgot about Love and War.
Yeah, which I think Raina might have adapted as well. Mm-hmm. I can't remember. Yeah, she did feel more clunky than I remember her feeling in the books. Because in the book, she felt quite fresh, and yeah, she felt deliberately fresh. She felt challenging, as if she was challenging the medium. Not the medium, challenging the concept.
The concepts, I'm with you.
Yes, and she felt like that's what she was there to do in a way. It was new writers using her to challenge the way that Doctor Who had become stagnant to some degree. And yeah, that could probably play against it as an audio. It's hard to say. She certainly never felt as powerful in the audio, and has nothing to do with her performance, nothing to do with the writing. It's just simply, as you say, it's sort of like the Beatles, isn't it? The Beatles were amazing in the day. To hear the Beatles in their day to a new person hearing them now, there's going to be a difference. Unless you're there at the time, you're not going to get the effect once you've seen so many variants thereof that have appeared after.
I don't know.
I certainly think so. Same like Doctor Who. Me watching the first episode of William Hartnell will be totally different to my mother watching it in 1963.
Yeah, I see what you mean. It depends what else you've seen, really, I suppose, doesn't it? Or what else you've
experienced. But, well, at the time, there was nothing like it. So, and the same with Benny. I mean, people don't really... I don't think you really appreciate how powerful the new adventures were and how challenging they were to fandom, unless you were there experiencing them at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, like I said, you know, kids these days would be absolutely shocked at how fandom rippled at Ben Arinovich's transit and the prostitute with the taste of semen in her mouth, which was a line in the book. And that caused absolute fury. Now, I'm not saying that it would be totally wholly accepted now, especially not in one of BBC's books, but... The notion of sexuality in Doctor Who wasn't there before that novel, really.
Mm.
That novel was the first time, effectively, that in Doctor Who there was this question of adult theme, of, you know, acknowledging adult behaviour. And that is part of the show now. So these are very different times that you're now replicating. And they seem, when I listened to Love and War, it didn't feel half as challenging as it did back in 91 or whenever it came out, 1990-91, whatever it was. And as I say, I don't think that's just the nature of the beast, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, so it'd be interesting to see how these two adaptations go. Obviously there's no Benny in the second one, in the Rusty Davies one, is there?
No, it's Ross and Chris, isn't it?
Yeah, Ross Frost, Chris Quedge. Yes, both excellent castings as well for that. So yeah,
I don't think I read. I used to think I read Damaged Goods, but I'm not sure I did now. So I would be interested in that purely because I think that would be fresh to me.
Mm.
But yeah.
Okay. Mm. Now there are a few other little bits and bobs which we could talk about, but we're kind of getting on for time. So We maybe talk about Peter Capaldi's being cut from Male Fisons, or however it is you pronounce it, next week. I'm a one, aren't I? And we'll go straight into recommendations.
We do that.
We'll do that then. Okay. Do you want to rumble?
I'm not quite sure what my answer should be to that.
Previously on next week's podcast.
Well, it's not that one. Anyway, it's like when radio goes a bit wrong and they put the wrong jingles on.
A bit like that.
Yeah. I need a soundboard with that's kind of finger friendly rather than mouse friendly. I think that's the problem. Recommendations is what we should have had there. A little rumble sound for recommendations. I have a feeling we may be talking about the same recommendation.
Okay.
Are we going to be talking about the same recommendation?
Probably.
Okay. Is it episode 8?
Might be.
Okay. so I'm just going to mention the Tommy Cooper book again, just so we've got a little bit of variety in our recommendations.
Yeah.
And did you have a book that you were talking about earlier?
Not unless it was some no. Oh yes, The Vault.
The Vault. That's right.
Yeah. I guess
it's got a lot of good stuff in it, hasn't it? It's just possibly
it has. It is actually deceptively. I think deceptively, it looks like a coffee table.
Exactly. Yeah, and it's a lot more to it than that. We were talking about Stephen Moffat earlier. Wouldn't it be great if there was a writer's tale of Stephen Moffat?
Oh yeah,
version said of the this writer's before, tale. Yeah. By Tom Spilsbury. It'd be really, really interesting.
I think my only problem with that is, and I could be wrong, could be doing him a disservice, I suspect he's a little more revisionist about history than Davis is. I think Davis is more of an apologetic type. Well, I think there's things that we'll have done which I reckon Moffat quite genuinely, not out of manipulation, will genuinely revise in his head.
Yeah.
While I think Davis is a far more self...
I think he's far more honest.
Self-crucifying. Yeah, well, you could call it honest. I think sometimes maybe he is far more self-deprecating.
Yeah,
probably
I
more
think
than he perhaps needs to be.
I used to really have a problem with him because with the old the press interviews and all that sort of stuff, and I just felt that he wasn't being sincere.
Who, Davis?
Davis, yeah, in what he was saying, yeah. And then there's a line or two in the book about him absolutely hating doing those things. So that's obviously what I was picking up.
Well, no, there is truth. I mean, I know journalists who have actually said that they've been in situations where he has been out of order.
Right.
And I don't, but then as you say, I don't mind that if people are honest about it and actually say, hold their hands up and say, yeah. And he does. I mean, he says in the book how he's terrible to the writers sometimes, and he says more than they deserve. And he says that's him. And so I don't mind that, but yeah, I can't say much about Moffat because I've not actually really seen him do the same sort of book to judge him, but I just imagine he'd be a little more revisionist. Mm. I'm not quite sure that his would be quite as honest and accurate. Mm. But anyway, we'd see.
Still be maybe fascinating in its own way.
It would certainly would. Well, absolutely. I mean, this is the whole thing, isn't it? I mean, you can take out of what people don't say can be as informative as what they do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, imagine a situation, dear listener, in which Doctor Who has been cancelled. It shouldn't be too difficult. Now, 20 years ago, that would be it for 15 years or whatever. But now what happens is the audience is spotted by another broadcaster, the decision questioned, and then an online company such as Amazon or Apple TV or whoever, or Netflix, comes along with a load of money and says, here's some money, we're commissioning you, we'll throw it on for you. This is what happened to Ripper Street, which after its second series, its very good second series, I might add, was cancelled by the BBC. It didn't get trailed an awful lot for the first series or the second series, Ripper Street, so it perhaps wasn't an immense surprise that the BBC BBC One decided that they didn't want it anymore. But what happened is, as you may have heard in previous podcasts, is that Amazon came to the rescue, as it was, and over the last 8 weeks, they've been screening, or releasing every Friday night, I should say. Screening is the wrong word, because you screen on demand at your pleasure. The third series of Ripper Street, and it's just finished with the piece of Mr. Edmund Reed.
Mm.
And now, we're in a bit of a funny situation with this, is because it's going to be on BBC, and it's going to be on BBC America, so we can't go into too much. We don't want to spoil it for you, because it's really not worth spoiling. It's a really, really well-produced, well-written, and superbly executed series, so we don't want to spoil anything for you, but we really do need to talk about it. So, and also the thing is, neither of us have actually spoken to each other about it, have we, on the podcast?
No.
There's been other things going on, or one of us hasn't been available. So how have you felt about the whole series?
Yeah, I thought it was a lot better than series two.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, from what I understand, there are some of the rumbles of the BBC at the time which got it removed, aside from the fact that they'd put virtually zero effort into the promotion of the second series, was the fact that they felt it was getting too insular, that it was folding in on the cast too much and losing sight of its original premise,
mm-hmm.
which was about the murders and the horrors of Whitechapel. It was becoming about, you know, what's the problem with Edmund Reed this week, and or what's the problem with, you know, and to a certain degree that still exists in the third series, but it just works. It is very insular, but at the same time it feels far more like a book, and I think part of that is because they're given so much more freedom. So it doesn't. Do you know what I mean? It felt series felt self-contained, but it didn't feel forced. It flowed. Compared, and I don't want to make unfair comparisons, but compared to say Doctor Who, this last series where it felt the continuity arc felt forced and awkward, and part of that may be because you have set time schedules.
Mm-hmm.
Like I've said a million times now, you know, Into the Dalek for me felt failed because Danny Pink took up too much time for them to be able to focus on the expendable characters in the Dalek. So when they died, you didn't really care. Now, if that show had been allowed to run to 60 minutes or 70 minutes, and so it could have done both, it would have felt far much better. And that's what Ripper Street could do on its new format. Because scheduling isn't important anymore. Because there's no scheduling, because advertisement isn't and it doesn't work through advertisement either in the same way that broadcasting does, or certainly for BBC shouldn't, obviously, but because all those things are removed, it can run as a far more free flow. If it needs to be 70 minutes, it can be 70 minutes. If it needs to only be 62, it can be just 62. And that means you don't lose data, and everything feels, I think, far more fluid.
Yeah, wouldn't argue with that. I must admit, I don't know how long the last episode was, but it seemed to be almost feature film length at one point.
I don't think it was much different.
Was it not much different from the other ones, like 106, 107?
I am not. I couldn't say
1 hour 6, 1 hour 7. Yeah, it probably was. Yeah. But it was absolutely intriguing. I think part of that is possibly because of what you've already said, the kind of novel-esque attitude to it. You come into each episode knowing what's happened previously and it having a relevance, and perhaps feeling that it's longer than it is because you know a bit more about the episode.
I think it ties
back to other events as well, doesn't it?
Well, I think second series also suffered a bit because it had one long ongoing antagonist, which got a bit irritating. But in this series, the antagonists vary, and it's all interlinked.
Yeah.
But it's not all repetitive. You're not sort of going through the same thing of, oh, when are they going to find this person out, or when are they going to stop him, because it's not flowing like that.
Yeah, it's actually, when you say it's interlinked, it's almost forensically interlinked in some ways, isn't it? Because it goes very deep. I suppose that's a double meaning what I've just said as well. But it seems there's an immense amount of attention has been put to linking everything together in a way that doesn't seem anal. It just seems, wow, yeah. It all links.
And you've got a perfect cast. You've got a gorgeous script. And something I must note this series is that they really changed the palette. Did you notice that?
Yes.
I've just got series one and two for Christmas. I've not rewatched it. But the palette is so vibrant. It feels a different show. So, it was brilliant. What else was I going to say about it that I thought was quite... I thought interesting, the best episode for me was the episode which felt like it was the episode done on the cheap that was set entirely in the station house.
Yes, with the... during the night.
Yes.
Yes, it was very good, yeah.
Standalone, it was very divorced from the rest of the storylines going on, and it was just beautifully put together.
Mm. Yeah, that was very good. And also, I really struggle to say this without spoiling anything, but I'm going to have a go. The fact that the lights kept going out led me to believe that something else was... That what was happening wasn't actually happening, and it was happening elsewhere if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. Because of the situation that a particular character was in the previous episode.
Yeah.
Yeah, right, okay. So it's
interesting. I haven't thought about that.
Yeah. So it's a wonderful series. If you do get the chance to watch it, I mean, it's going to be on BBC One, I believe. It's definitely going to be on BBC America because they've also co-funded. And it'll be out on DVD in the not-too-distant future as well.
What will be interesting will be how the industry reacts to this or whether it has already started to react. Because from how I sort of understand it, you know, the BBC weren't really quite prepared for it to be taken in such a quick and fast manner. And whether the contracts will now change to stop that from happening. Or whether the creative side will be able to make sure that contracts are open enough in the opening bidding. So if you're a strong enough, if you've got enough capital, enough creative capital, whether you'll be able to argue out to make sure you've got the freedom that you can go into that sort of arrangement if things don't go well. I mean, it's an interesting thing because in a sense it could serve BBC well. You know, you spread the costs of funding in a time where costs are being cut. You still get air. You get second dibs, but you still get to air the show as well.
Yeah.
It's interesting to see where the industry will flow from here.
Can you see them doing something similar with Doctor Who, do you think? In terms of
funding and
budgets?
Well, that's it. I mean, did you feel a change in the budget particularly? Did you feel it was less? I don't believe there was much change.
I think the CG, I feel, and this is partly due to the HD. It's not partly due to HD. There's a lot of this is to do with HD, is that the CGI doesn't seem to work as well.
I think there had to be, for practical reasons, not because of budgetary. I think there was some elements where they weren't able to get out on location as much as they wanted to.
And I also know that they've wheeled back on CGI a lot, whereas, you know, back when Phil Collinson was running things day to day, there was a lot of CGI for practical reasons. In those days, CGI was a lot more affordable. They didn't have, you know, there's obviously been an inflation issue in the British economy during Moffat's time, really, which affects things slightly in that respect. And I know that they do prefer model work now. There's a lot of model work, say, in The Day of the Doctor, isn't there?
Yeah.
And I'm a big fan of model work, don't get me wrong. But like the base the other night, the first establishing shot in Last Christmas of the base was, if anything, it was too fast because the radar array dish type thing was an octagonal sort of a shape. But because there wasn't enough time to appreciate exactly what you were seeing, it looked like a very bad circle. A very bad CG circle. So,
well, my issue with that establishing shot was it was too filtered, and I thought they were on another planet. So there was an argument there where the CG and the post work was just too glitzed.
Perhaps
to hide some of the
perhaps
CG.
To hide something. And, yeah. So again, well, but again,
maybe I'm just an idiot.
Well, no, again, maybe it's another vote in favour of models.
Well, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. So now with Ripper Street, do you feel that that's it?
I don't believe it will be.
No. Do you believe it will return with the same cast?
Yeah, I think it probably will. I think unless they've obviously got better things going.
Yeah.
It looks like a great show to work on. I imagine for an actor, given that it has its script is so so colourful and thespic, maybe in its nature. I think it'd be hard pushed to sort of walk away from that unless you really felt you had to.
I think the story with Reed and his daughter's kind of done, really, isn't it? So I think if they did bring it back, they'd have to skip forward a few more years and maybe have her away at finishing school or something.
Well, they've got an interesting problem that Reed is based on a real life character. So I don't know whether that means that whether they got to get to a point where they deviate or whether they have got to the point where they've deviated to a point where you've got to accept that it's, you know, that they're not following history, or whether that will constrain them to how they deal with the character. I don't know. I'd certainly be disappointed if they change the cast. The cast is just too good.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, so that is a kind of a unified recommendation, really, isn't it?
The only other recommendation I will throw at you, because I've just been watching on a whim, was I've been rewatching Firefly. Joss Whedon's wonderful series, which got a bad badly screwed over by the network. Mm-hmm. Who will be nameless, though most Americans listening to this would be able to guess if they didn't already know which network probably screwed it over. But it's a beautiful series. If you've not seen it, do watch it on DVD. Again, like Ripper Street, it's got very lovely prose to it, lovely language. Beautifully put together, great cast. And again, it's an example maybe of a series that while it was cut off before its time, it only got 13 episodes, I think, and a film. Does that not make it more classic? Does that not make it more beautiful? It doesn't have the opportunity to fail. It doesn't have the opportunity for people to become divisive over whether it's any good or not, as we perhaps have with Doctor Who now.
Perhaps.
Yes. How many people, you'll find people who absolutely embrace my friend Adam, who
I've never met him. I haven't embraced him.
No, you haven't. Although he has actually submitted stuff for the website before.
Right.
Some of the BFI stuff he reported on for us.
Ah, right, yeah.
Adam, he loves Stephen Moffat's stuff far more than I generally do, even though, as I say, I think this was a fantastic episode. And he will often be on the opposite end of the spectrum with me on Doctor Who for various reasons. And, you know, it becomes divisive, doesn't it? As something becomes long running, you gain your own opinion of how it should be or what it's about, and you split. But if you have a show which is very short, you don't have that room to split.
Yeah.
So I think that's why Firefly probably has a beautiful legacy, while Babylon 5, The X-Files may not. Which I may also just very quickly recommend on backtofrankblack.com, the Joe Harris interview we did for the comic writer of the X-Files comic and Millennium comic is now online. So if you're interested in the X-Files comic or the Millennium comic, go on there to listen to that.
If you're intrigued by anything that we've just referred to there will be links in the show notes, dear listener.
Good.
Okay. So, you know, last week, if I'd have been on last week's podcast, and sadly I wasn't able to join you guys, I would have been talking about the Box of Delights. But I think I did that last year and the year before, so I'm not going to over-egg the pudding. But if you do spot it on Amazon, and you're still feeling festive, and you've got a fast delivery option selected, that is a nice evening's classic BBC TV children's adventure series for you to enjoy, to extend your Christmas.
And that was the Patrick Troughton.
Yeah.
Patrick Troughton, who, he always felt like he was in it far more than he actually was.
Yeah, he's only in like two and a bit episodes, or two episodes, yeah.
Absolutely. Well, my final recommendation is on the basis of Christmas and Patrick Troughton in a different way.
Okay.
Not the Box of Delights. Because if you haven't already watched it, between the 2nd of December to the 21st of December 1968, ran the Patrick Troughton adventure, The Invasion. So if you've not watched it, I recommend this week.
Do you know,
this
I was thinking to myself, he's not going to. He's not. No, really, he's not. It must be something else.
Yeah, The Invasion, which should have aired Christmas week, December 1968, the final episode.
Excellent. Okay. So that brings us to the end
of
this
week's. My pleasure.
Yes, thank you, James. This does bring us to the end of this week's Castover's podcast with a K. Hopefully,
do make sure that's in the notes.
What, The Invasion? The Invasion will be in the notes, yes. Don't you worry.
Good.
Don't you worry.
Good.
We will return, hopefully, as a triumvirate for next week's podcast. But until then, it is goodbye from us. Bye-bye.
Yes. That was good sherry.
Was it?
I had sherry through this.
Did you?
My companion podcaster on the other podcast, he finds it disgusting that I drink sherry.
Why? Why is it disgusting?
He's American.
Right.
It's just not his sort of thing.
Would he prefer you were cracking open a bottle of Bud between your ass cheeks?
Precisely. So I drink this for him.